Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says the recent riots and unrest in the country were orchestrated by the US, the Zionist regime of Israel, and their paid agents. Israeli forces killed two Palestinians in the occupied West Bank following an alleged attempt to conduct a ramming attack against regime forces. Also in the headlines, the International Energy Agency calls on Europe to lower gas consumption during the winter amid fears of a total cutoff of Russian supplies. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Now, top story this hour, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the recent riots in the country were plotted by the United States, Israel, and their paid agents. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made the comment in an address to military cadets in Tehran. The leader said he was saddened by the death of a young woman which triggered the riots, but he said the reactions to the incident, including insecurity on the streets and the burning of the Holy Quran and mosques, were not normal. Ayatollah Khamenei said the death of the young woman was a pretext for some foreign governments to foment insecurity and rioting. The leader added that such governments cannot tolerate Iran's progress and power. Ayatollah Khamenei described those governments as bullies, saying they are taking aim at Iran's independence, resistance, and power. UK-based political analyst Masood Shejara says the tragic death of Mahsa Amini has been used as a pretext by Iran's adversaries to instigate rioting in Iran.
It is a very sad affair of lives of loss of the life of a young woman, but this is not the issue. This has been an excuse for rioting, killing people, burning security officers, and burning buildings, etc., etc. And you know, it's very clear for a very long time. Opponents of Iran, the regime in occupied Palestine, United States and Saudis and have been saying very clearly that they are set to create disharmony. They are there to actually create havoc within Iran and create this type of thing. And even when we hear the maximum pressure is a catalyst for creating the environment when this sort of thing could take place. This is really trying to create a sort of havoc that was indeed implemented in Libya, in Syria, and elsewhere. This is actually trying to destroy the whole infrastructure and bring such insecurity, which will affect every Iranian, be it their supporter or opponent of any issue whatsoever.
And Iran has urged European countries to fulfill their international obligations and provide full security to its diplomatic missions. That's after violent protests hit several Iranian embassies in European capitals. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says the attacks were carried out by violent people affiliated with anti-Iran groups. Kanani was referring to a number of gatherings outside Iranian missions over the death of Mahsa Amini. The protests turned violent in London and Oslo, where several people were arrested by the local police. Kanani says the attackers managed to damage the outer sections of Iranian diplomatic missions as host countries failed to properly protect them. The Palestinian Prime Minister has urged the international community to hold the Israeli regime accountable for its atrocities almost on a daily basis across the occupied territories. Speaking at the weekly cabinet meeting, Mohammed Shataya also called for an immediate end to the regime's bloody escalation and serious violations of the Palestinians' rights. Meantime, people in the Jalazun refugee camp in the north of Ramallah have staged the protests against the Israeli killing of two Palestinians in an overnight attack. The two men were shot dead in connection with what the regime claims was an attempted car ramming attack on its forces in the West Bank. The reports say the incident took place while Israeli troops were carrying out a raid on a Palestinian refugee camp in the area. The European Union always condemns Israel when it comes to its violations in the occupied Palestinian territories, including the regime's illegal settlement activities or abuse of Palestinians. But in practice, the EU's support for Israel remains ironclad. The EU's disregard for human rights and democracy has become even more blatant in recent years, which shows how its words of condemnations do not represent its actual notion of human rights.
When it comes to the relationship between the EU and Israel, one thing is evident. The EU comes out defending Palestinians and condemns Israel for its different violations, from settlements to the killing of Palestinians. But words of condemnations are just that, words. For when it comes to doing anything about it, it does absolutely nothing. There is a broad consensus that the EU is not an honest broker when it comes to Israel and Palestine, and that the very DNA of the Israel-EU relationship reveals that on Palestinian rights, Brussels only condemns Israeli illegal acts. Be it in response to the unfounded allegations in the 2021 dossier, which offered no proof to justify the terror label for Palestinian groups, or to the all-frequent military onslaught on Gaza. The EU has done little to hold Israel accountable besides ritual but ineffectual expressions of concern. In fact, the EU recently reiterated its commitment to developing closer diplomatic ties and agreed to resume meetings of the EU-Israel Association Council. Another sign of Europe's somewhat covert support for Israel is a memorandum of understanding between the EU, Egypt, and Israel, where Cairo is set to export Israeli gas to Europe. All this has also shed light on the West's double standards regarding the Palestine-Israel conflict, and this has only been further clarified through the West's support of Ukraine in light of the Russian special military operation there. The world rallied behind Ukraine and left Palestinians frustrated, who witnessed being criminalized and were constantly being told that they don't have the right to resist, or even labeled as terrorists or anti-Semites just for asking for their rights. Despite the long list of horrific human rights violations in Palestine and other atrocities in the world, the West is yet to display a unified response to the Israeli aggressions. But what makes matters worse is the West claims it supports human rights, like for Palestinians, yet it continues to do nothing when it comes to the Israeli violations of Palestinian rights.
Turning to Russia now, where members of the lower house of parliament approve legislation to annex four Ukrainian regions into the country. The State Duma voted to incorporate Donetsk, Lugansk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia with no abstentions or votes against the ratification. Russia's upper house, the Federation Council, is expected to formalize the annexation on Tuesday. Last Friday, President Vladimir Putin signed a decree for the formal accession of the territories to Russia. Moscow says people in the four regions have voted overwhelmingly to join the Russian Federation in referendums held last week, but Ukraine and its Western allies have called the votes illegal and a sham. It's time now for our news review segment. The International Energy Agency says Europe must reduce gas consumption ahead of winter to survive the impact of Russia's halt to its natural gas flow to the continent. The agency says Russia's reduced flows to Europe deepen market tensions as global gas demands are expected to fall by 0.8% this year. The IEA says it also disrupts trade flow, leading to fuel shortages in some emerging and developing economies ahead of the winter. The IEA has also anticipated that markets will remain tight well into 2023. Russia supplied about 40% of European gas consumption before the Ukraine war. Russian gas flows are still running, but at severely reduced rates, pushing prices to record levels. Moscow says Western sanctions have hindered gas exports. European politicians say that's just a pretext and Russia is using energy as a weapon. Joining us for more on that is Jerome Hughes, our correspondent in Brussels, and also John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst from Belgrade. Gentlemen, welcome. Jerome, if I could start with you. So the fear is Russia shutting off the taps completely. Is there any indication from Brussels about lifting some of the sanctions on the Russian energy sector to allow Europeans to heat their homes?
Well, the reality is that the European Union is looking at every other place that it can in terms of trying to get in energy to try and to eliminate the need to bring in energy from Russia. After decades of us getting cheap gas from Russia directly piped into the European Union. And you know what people, more and more ordinary people, are asking right now is how bad could it actually get? Because we see rising inflation, it's rising by the day, and in response to that, the European Central Bank in the 19-country Eurozone is increasing interest rates. So people's home loans, the mortgages are going up every single month. And people are wondering, you know, if we get a very cold winter, how bad could this crisis actually get? Because, of course, we need energy to run the whole economy in terms of transporting goods and food items and so on. Food prices are very, very high. So really, people are worried about how bad things could get, not only from an economic perspective and from an energy perspective, which is what we're talking about now, but also militarily. People are more and more worried that this could escalate further and that we could be heading towards World War III. I mean, really, you know, when we talk about that, it sounds very alarmist, but really that's what people are asking. Are we pushing Russia to the point, is the West pushing Russia to the point where we could have a complete collapse and World War III? And also more and more people, when we talk about energy bills, when we talk about food prices, when we talk about inflation and interest rates, more and more people are also asking, how did we get here? You know, instead of just talking about the cost of energy, we have to go back. I mean, I've been in Brussels here for almost 10 years, attending all of the NATO meetings, and all of those meetings over the past 10 years have been dominated by the issue of Russia. We need to control Russia. There was never any ruling out of Ukraine joining NATO or joining the European Union. There was this constant provocation towards Russia. And so now more and more people are being educated, and this is where the conversation is switching to, is how did we get here? How did our politicians, our Western leaders, actually manage to get us to a situation where not only are we seeing record inflation, energy prices, food prices, but also the potential for World War III?
Right. What's your take on that, John? Was this a long-term strategy to contain countries that pursue independent political, economic policies such as Russia, such as Iran, such as China?
Absolutely. That's a continuation of the containment policy used against the Soviet Union. Many people expected that when the Soviet Union collapsed and when the people of Russia chose to establish a multi-party democracy and a largely capitalist economy that would be competitive with the West, that it would be a time of peace. In fact, what the West wanted to do was to destroy Russia, break it up into pieces, and colonize it, not to have a new competitor who could take business away from them. So we're seeing the coming to a head of the destructive policies of the West that created a situation in which they're doing exactly what they said they would not do, and that is destroying the non-communist multi-party democracy that has emerged from the former Soviet Union.
And John, is there any hope for European consumers, European families, European pensioners this winter?
Well, there is hope, and that is the basic hope that all of us have about our political leaders, and that is that they will come to their senses. We have a political class that actually does not use brains here in Europe. Most of Europe is a military, political, or economic colony of the United States. And in many cases, it's a colony in all three aspects. when you have a country which has a ruling class, which is remote controlled by puppet strings leading to Washington via London, then what you have is a group of people who do not think for themselves. And this kind of a crisis in which the people of their own nations are going to assert their own control over their own leadership, this is the kind of crisis that can actually produce a democracy. And that's what I expect to see happen. The people of Europe have a long tradition of political activity at the grassroots level. When they do not have heat in wintertime, when their children are getting ill and sick, and when their elderly are dying in the cold, they are going to rise up against their leaders, and their leaders are then going to have to choose between their own people and their puppet masters in Washington. And generally speaking, when the puppet masters are a long way away, cutting the strings becomes much, much easier to do.
Right. Jerome, is there any acknowledgement at all in Brussels that the US-led sanctions have backfired essentially against the European households who are suffering the most out of all of this?
No, any time that this is raised with Ursula von der Leyen, the head of the European Commission, or any of the individual leaders across the 27 member states, or the EU foreign policy chief, the immediate answer is no, this is all Russia's fault. So they don't talk, they never talk about sanctions backfiring. And also this issue of replacing energy supplies from Russia. I mean, if you speak to economists, if you speak to energy experts, it's not simply a case of replacing, bringing in huge amounts of liquefied natural gas from the United States and from other areas, from North Africa and from, you know, other parts of Europe and so on in the Middle East. It's not a case when you just simply replace the energy, there's huge costs associated with that. So it's not just a case of, oh, yes, we've managed to get our energy reserves up to a certain point. It costs a fortune to bring in this energy when we were getting it very cheap in the pipelines from Russia. So actually, the knock-on effect keeps going. And we haven't seen anything yet because, of course, we have seen massive energy prices and businesses, small businesses going out of business, even larger businesses going down. And that's set to continue if we see the current trend, because as the demand for energy increases and as the prices keep pushing up, businesses will fold, but also there will be a knock-on effect for the politicians, because we haven't seen the major political ramifications yet. Ordinary citizens, they really will get upset with their politicians.
Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for your thoughts. Let me thank our guests. Jerome Hughes is our correspondent joining us from Brussels, and John Bosnich is a journalist, activist and political analyst joining us from Belgrade.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Economic divide.
Ties between Russia and Iran have reached new highs. Between the two most sanctioned countries in the world, trade has reached an all-time high, and Iran recently hosted the biggest Russian delegation to ever come to Iran. What does this mean for the two countries? Well, that's obvious, but what it spells for the rest of the world, in particular Europe and the U.S., is that they could potentially lose out on the market of both countries, which between the two have considerable oil and gas reserves. Hello and welcome to Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, Russian delegation, 65 Russian companies, biggest trade delegation ever to visit Iran from Russia. Oil, automotive, and financial sectors were some of the companies that joined from those particular fields. Also, we will take a look at some of the recent Iran-Russia agreements, which has been in overdrive, like a gas swap deal, this automotive cooperation, And Iran and Russia will establish trade centers in order to help present the products that will be exchanged between the two. And another area of importance between these two countries is that, well, they're the sanctioned ones. They have ditched the dollar. They will cooperate on evading sanctions. And also, a new sanctions evasion corridor is in the works.
As the crisis between Russia and the West continues to get worse, Russia is turning to alternative markets and business partners to counter sanctions imposed by the West on its allies. Iran, which is Russia's southern neighbor, is one of those partners. Tehran and Moscow have now decided to cement their trade and business ties, since both of them are targeted by cruel Western sanctions. As part of their expanding ties, a delegation from Russia has now visited Iran to boost ties. A delegation of 100 people representing 65 Russian companies has held 3 days of talks with Iranian counterparts in Tehran. The Russian delegation visiting Tehran was comprised of representatives from various companies, including manufacturers of food products, agricultural machinery, pharmaceuticals, and leading suppliers of communication equipment. More than 750 face-to-face meetings were held between Iranian and Russian businesses over the visit. Russia plans to dispatch at least 10 other business delegations to Iran until the end of this year. Members of provincial chambers of commerce from across Iran attended the planned meetings with the Russian delegation.
We produce technological machinery for different industries, including in the automotive sector. Today, we talked to several Iranian companies, and I am sure we will launch a joint venture with a number of them.
The sanctions cannot be a serious obstacle to business activities between us and Russians, because if there is a will to do business, there's a way. The U.S. measures can only complicate the payment channels for us, but we can do our transactions via our national currencies.
Iran's Ministry of Trade now says trade with Russia was in surplus for the first time in July through August amid a surge in sales of manufacturing products to Russian customers. The Islamic Republic of Iran Shipping Line Group, IRISL, has also reported a record high in its freight services between Russia and India through a newly launched corridor. It has shipped 27,520-foot-long containers, or the equivalent of 337,000 metric tons of cargo, between Russia and India in the 4 months to late July.
When it comes to the online post about the topic at hand, obviously it's a big deal. But viewers saw it differently. They wanted to see where this was going to go in terms of the comments that they left, in terms of Iran and Russia, for example, being two countries that have been sanctioned heavily by the West. What this relationship is going to morph into. Let's find out what some of their thoughts are on this. First, Iran and Russia to establish trade centers. The two countries will focus on energy-related trading and establishing a north-south corridor to rival the Suez Canal. Next, Iran and Russia agree on the transit of 10 million tons of goods. The Russian side agreed to invest in establishing logistic hubs to increase transit capacity, especially in Shahid Rajai and Chabahar ports in southern Iran. Then came a viewer comment that really explained the whole lot, giving this another angle and depth. The whole threat of sanctions is now over. Any other country that America will want to sanction will immediately receive overtures from BRICS countries to trade and prosper. America will become economically toothless and won't be able to continue to wage economic war. This is why Putin said that the sanctions are good. This is the beginning of the end of economic terror that the U.S. relied upon. They picked on the wrong country. Russia is not Venezuela, according to this particular viewer anyways. Our final post here is about Russia and Iran, how they are looking to team up against what's called Western deception. That has been something that Iran's leader has said, where he has called for long-term cooperation between Iran and Russia. And he told the Russian President Vladimir Putin that the two countries needed to stay vigilant against what he called Western deception. Okay, Iran's leader, and a post that concerned him and his opinion on this. All right, let me introduce our guest for this program. We have Bijan Tavassoli join us. He's the Chief Executive Officer at MacGillegis, and he joins us to share with us his thoughts on this. Bijan Tavassoli, welcome to Economic Divide. Shortly after the Islamic Republic actually signed documents pertaining to its membership of the SCO, you had the announcement of this Russian delegation. Tell us why this is such a big deal.
Full membership of the largest regional organization will certainly increase and deepen Iran's ties with its most important neighbors. Russia and Iran have complementary strong points, particularly in the agricultural sector and regarding industrial output. Where they have strengths, such as in the petrochemical sector, both Iran and Russia are world leading in this sector and in the energy sector as a whole. There, I think they will certainly benefit from exchanging their experiences and skills, as well as from more coordination on the supply side, as they have previously already done with negotiations in the framework of OPEC+.
Okay, let's find out what Ahmad Abu Meri thinks. Ahmad Abu Meri is the head of external sales at Fingo, and he's an expert on international trade relations who's based in Moscow. Good to get a Russian side of things on this. Ahmad Abu Meri, welcome to Economic Divide. Taking a look at what has occurred over here, first of all, in terms of this delegation, obviously that's important. Lots of sectors covered between the two. But in the bigger picture, you have countries, Iran and Russia, who are now part of this, if you want to call it, grouping of countries that are part of the Eurasian Economic Union, for example, and also we're looking at BRICS countries. Tell us how this is going to impact trade globally and how it will take away trade from other countries like the U.S. and maybe the EU in terms of the union there.
Yes, of course. We now can see the huge business between Russia, China, and India in the gas and oil sectors. And in Iran also, we found a delegate from 60 different business sectors which visiting Iran. So the sanctions affecting the West and not countries which are under sanctions. And I am sure that soon we will see a front to force the West, and again we can see East Bloc and West Bloc.
Time now for our info news section of the program. There were lots of news from this past week. These are the ones that we picked. First up, we go to an issue that Germany is facing, and that is food shortages. What is going on there? German producers are warning of that. They can't cope with soaring energy costs, and because of that, they've issued that warning. Manufacturers are saying that this may soon force them to actually stop operations. Again, the EU powerhouse issuing a warning like that, somebody's got to listen. The EU needs to do something about that at a minimum. Next up, we go to what we found to be a really interesting piece of news because it has to deal with Islam and Muslims. And this particular piece of news is very interesting in terms of what they have done. Now, one in three Southeast Asian Muslims, they've actually turned out to be more devout than their parents, if you can believe that. That's based on a report that came out. Now, the resurgent religious faith and Western-style consumerism are the two factors that have actually transformed the consumer habits of the region's Muslims, according to the survey. This is particularly focused on the Asian side of where Muslims are inhabiting. So very interesting. We figured since this has to deal with Muslim consumer habits or buying habits that we should highlight that. Next up, an issue that is not really talked about much or covered as much, and it's called dark money in the West Asia region and money lobbying. Dark money in money lobbying. Saudi lobbyist and ex-U.S. senator oversee millions in Republican campaign donations. That's right. Actually, this is not something that is new, but again, it's worth highlighting. This former U.S. senator has played a dual role of Saudi lobbyist and chair of the GOP super PAC. So you can see how dark money from the Saudi side is doing its thing when it comes to U.S. politicians. And then next up, we're going to take a look at the U.K. economy. Gosh, we have covered the U.K. economy so often in this program. But the new prime minister, not so new at this point really, is sending investors fleeing with historic tax cuts and borrowing. Liz Truss is now facing some heat on that. Meanwhile, Britain's new finance minister made that announcement and said it has unleashed historic tax cuts and huge increases in borrowing, which has affected businesses in that country. Those are the ones that we picked.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the in-depth section of the program. Now, this in-depth section is meant to show what happens when the new world order is taking shape and with two key players of that new world order and how they are elevating their trade status. Well, when they do that to considerable proportions, there's a large impact that happens as a result. For example, when it comes to exports between Russia and Iran, well, the field is not really an even one. We could take a look at Russian exports. We went from the years 2016 through 17, all the way through 2021 and 2022. So Russian exports to be between $1.1 to $1.5 billion annually, except for the year 2017 and 2018. It peaked at $1.6 billion annually between 2021 to 2022. Meanwhile, Iran's exports risen conservatively from 2016-17, steadily as that figure has more than doubled over to over $560 million. So there you have how trade stood between the two. Now, a snapshot of the types of products that is being shipped is also worth taking a look at, since these areas are surely in areas that are going to grow. For example, food exports for both countries ranks at the top of the list. You're seeing 78% of Iranian exports to Russia. We took the year 2019 as a snapshot before COVID came. Chemical products at 7%. And then metals 4%, plastic and rubbers, and the other at 8%. Food products is a whopping 78%. So it leaves room for other categories to actually improve. Now, in the year 2020, there were about $1.5 billion in exports versus the $627 million in the trade balance compared to the year 2021, where exports stood at a little over $3 billion versus a little over $2 billion in the trade balance. So obviously a huge difference showing the rebound that has happened between the two countries in terms of their trade, and of course this graph displays that fully. And finally, given the transformation taking place for Russia to shift to the east, well, surely there's going to be countries that are going to be replaced based on what countries Russia did trade with because of the conflict that has happened in Ukraine and of course because of the sanctions. Here you have some of the countries that Russia has done trade with in terms of the top, well, we're looking at about 10 of them. China, of course, is going to remain at number one, but when you take a look at countries like Netherlands, Germany, maybe even South Korea or Italy, United Kingdom for sure, these numbers are going to reshuffle or they're going to go out the picture and have other countries replace that because the conflict in Ukraine and the sanctions as a result of it will mean that Russia will be looking for new trading partners where it can export its products to. Okay, time for an analysis. Let's have our guests rejoin us. First, we'll bring back the Chief Executive Officer at MACGI Legis, Bijan Tavassoli, who rejoins us. Bijan, the relationship between countries that are sanctioned by the U.S., such as Iran and Russia, well, they can overcome many problems. But tell us how things stand when the Americans think whatever country they impose sanctions on, that their trading activities is going to be stopped.
The illegal U.S. sanctions policy is having an effect quite contrary to that intended by the White House. In forcing more and more nations out of their Washington consensus, Western imperialists are driving those very nations closer together. The deep and enduring friendship between the people of Venezuela and Iran is just one example of that unlikely Western intervention. In sanctioning Russia, Washington has precluded any opportunity for Western European integration of the Russian Federation. They have forced Moscow policymakers to choose the only remaining, the only viable alternative pathway. Meanwhile, the relative lack of damages inflicted upon the Russian economy demonstrates that the specter of U.S. sanctions has lost much of its former coercive power. The future of the US dollar as a global reserve currency and as an instrument of US hegemony is now highly contingent upon developments that the Americans can no longer fully control.
Well, let's see what Ahmad Abumeri thinks. He rejoins us, head of the external cells in Flingo, an expert on international trade relations who's based in Moscow. Ahmad, I'd like to elaborate more on how you have countries that are being sanctioned by the U.S. And in this case, the point, obviously, Russia and Iran are two of them, because the U.S. thinks that whatever country they impose sanctions on, that they can be stopped. However, we're looking at the fact that these countries like Iran, China, and Russia are proving that perception to be wrong. In what ways do you think that's happening, if you agree?
Okay, thank you for this question. This is a good question, by the way. So let me tell you that the BRICS are not weak countries. They are five of the strongest economy in the world. So when you talk about China and Russia, those countries have a self-sanction. Then here are India, Brazil, South Africa. They are a very emerging economy, according to the International Monetary Fund. So in my mind, this is a big success, and the door is open for other countries to join. As we know now, Egypt, Algeria, and Iran, and other countries discussing the joining for BRICS. Finally, I would like to say that joining the BRICS is a big advance for any country, especially those countries which do not have enough energy, gas, and oil. And to keep in mind that the BRICS members are represent 40% of the world population and just over a quarter of global GDP.
Ties between Iran and Russia are set to expand even further after Iran gained full membership of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. The SCO, which is made up of China, India, Pakistan, Russia, and the ex-Soviet Central Asian nations of Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan, was set up in 2001 as a political, economic, and security organization to rival Western institutions. Russia, along with China, are key players there. Iran's accession to the organization can further help Tehran and Moscow boost the trade ties.
We saw how popular Iran's products are, and there's vast potential for cooperation. Contrary to the assumptions that Iran can be isolated through sanctions and threats, we saw the enthusiasm of regional countries to engage with Iran.
Early in 2022, Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi visited Moscow, which was described as a turning point in the ties between Russia and Iran. Back then, political, economic, energy, trade, and space issues were among topics discussed in Moscow. Iran and Russia are also trying to finalize a 20-year long-term partnership agreement, which will further increase their ties.
Relations between Russia and Iran are developing on all the vectors that have been formed in previous years. We are in the final stage of working on a new major treaty between Russia and Iran, which will mark the developing of relations at the level of a strategic partnership.
Iran is also joining the Eurasian Economic Union, which is an economic union of some post-Soviet states located in Eurasia. Russia is an important partner in that union. Iran's membership in that union will give Iran and Russia a greater chance to boost their bilateral ties. Iran has also applied for membership at the BRICS group of nations. There, ties between Iran and Russia will also get more enhanced, which includes trade and business ties.
The trade and economic relationship between Iran and Russia is in overdrive when it comes to the signing of agreements. Let's begin with one of the biggest ones between the two, a 20-year cooperation agreement. Iran and Russia are determined to update the 20-year cooperation treaty they had signed in 2001. The agreement was originally meant to last for 10 years, but it has twice been extended for 5 years. In bilateral relations, The two countries are determined to update the treaty on the basis of mutual relations and principles of cooperation between Iran and Russia in harmony with global developments. That's what the Iranian Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian has said. Then came the Russian investment of $40 billion in Iran's oil sector. This was announced during Russian President Vladimir Putin's visit to Iran and may have been motivated by U.S. sanctions. Russia will invest $40 billion in Iran's oil industry, building upon the $4 billion the Eurasian country has already invested in the sector. The move follows a cooperation agreement between the Russian companies, including the gas giant Gazprom and the Islamic Republic. To put things into perspective, Russia and Iran, the number one and two world's largest gas reserves, are best placed to coordinate the reserves and control prices. Russia has around 48 trillion cubic meters of gas reserves, while Iran possesses 38 trillion cubic meters. But the details of this massive agreement are multifaceted because it involves another major cooperation, a gas swap deal. First, Iran would soon purchase 9 million cubic meters of gas per day from Russia via Azerbaijan. The ministry also stated that it will soon receive 6 million cubic meters of gas per day from Russia as part of a swap agreement to export it in LNG, liquefied natural gas, to other countries from southern Iran. The agreement also calls for the completion of gas pipelines from Iran to Pakistan and Oman, as well as the completion of a number of LNG production projects in the country. The development of Iran's Kish and North Pars gas fields, as well as 6 oil fields, boosting pressure in the South Pars gas field, completion of LNG projects, swap of gas and petroleum products, and construction of gas transfer pipelines are among the highlights of the deal. That does it for this segment of the program.
The significance of this Russian delegation, which is the biggest one to ever come to the Islamic Republic, is huge. Aside from the fact that Russia and Iran are forging closer ties when it comes to trade and finance, what is big about this is that you have two super energy giants who are expanding their energy sales and also the way that they're going to transfer energy throughout the world. However, there's going to be two big losers on this, and that will be Europe and the U.S. Russia and Iran will definitely be looking for customers, especially Russia, based on the Ukraine conflict, to expand their trade in energy. Only time will tell how much of an increase that will be and how bad an impact that will have on Europe and the U.S. From Ikam Atali and the team, looking forward to seeing you next week.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
يا إلهي وربي وسيدي ومولاي لأي الأمور إليك أشكو ولما منها أضج وأبكي لأليم العذاب وشدته
Brothers and sisters, we were explaining this part of the Kumail supplication. Ya Ilahi wa Rabbi wa Sayyidi wa Mawlai. My Lord, my Lord, my Master and my Protector. لِأَيِّ الْأُمُورِ إِلَيْكَ أَشْكُ وَلِمَا مِنْهَا أَضِجُّ وَأَبْكِ. For which things would I complain to you, and for which of them would I lament and weep? لِأَلِيمِ الْعَذَابِ وَشِدَّتِهِ. For the pain and severity of chastisement. أَمْ لِطُولِ الْبَلَاءِ وَمُدَّتِهِ. Or for the length and period of the tribulations. Now, in the previous episode, we said that if we have a different angle of perspective, looking at weeping and lamenting, we will understand that weeping is one of Allah's greatest gifts to mankind and to the servants, because this implies riqqatul qalb and heart's humbleness. And this shows pure spirit of the servant. Muhammad bin Muslim says, once I inquired from Abu Ja'far, Imam Baqir alayhi salam, about this verse of chapter Mu'minun. This 76th verse of the chapter says, وَلَقَدْ أَخَذْنَاهُمْ بِالْعَذَابِ فَمَا اسْتَكَانُوا لِرَبِّهِمْ وَمَا يَتَضَرَّعُونَ. Yet they neither humbled themselves to their Lord, nor did they entreat him for mercy. I asked him about this verse, and he, alayhi salam, replied, humbling oneself, or istikana, means humility, while entreaty and tadarru means raising up the two hands in imploration. Now that we understand the reason behind why we are raising our hands to the skies, towards the skies, while we call the Almighty Allah, we would understand that it's really simple why we do this. Because some skeptics are putting people in doubt as to why we raise our hands towards the sky. Almighty Allah is not in the skies for us to raise our hands toward it. So why would we do that? This is the reason and logic behind it. This is why we take up this particular mode of prayer. And this is the mark of our humility. This is the mark of our neediness toward Allah. Because raising the two hands is a sign of indigence. And this mark has an inspiring effect in the softening of the heart. It removes hardness from the heart. It clears up the heart. And it draws its attention to Allah, the Blessed, the Exalted.
My God, my Lord, my King and Master, which of the matters shall I complain to you, and for which of them shall I wail and weep? Shall I wail for the pains of the punishment and its intensity, or for the length of my suffering and its duration?
Thank you, Allah. So good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So, when Imam Ali alayhi salam in this part says, لِأَيِّ الْأُمُورِ إِلَيْكَ أَشْكُ وَلِمَا مِنْهَا أَضِجُّ وَأَبْكِ, for which of the things should I lament and weep? This weeping is not forbidden. This weeping is the moment of the softening of the heart, and this is the exact moment of the descent of Allah's mercy. So, one should avail such moments by turning his attention to Allah for supplication. Because the mercy of the Almighty Allah is seen during those moments. But this does not imply that there is a specified time for coming down of Almighty Allah's mercy. Because the receiving of mercy has a specified time and a particular state, and that is the state of tenderness of the heart, that rikkatul qalb. And this is the time that most of the mercy of the Almighty Allah descends. The Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, is reported to have said, "Avail yourself of the opportunity of dua and prayer at the softening of the heart, because it is a mercy." In this regard, also Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, "When your skin quivers and your eyes shed tears, then you have drawn closer. Your need has been considered." This narration is precise. The acceptance of prayer has direct connection with the softening of the heart, with that weeping and lamentation as sign of riqqatul qalb. This is what we understand from this tradition. The more humble and the softer the heart becomes, this means the supplicant is closer to the response in his dua. And on the contrary, the harder and harsher the heart becomes, the less it will have tears, and the further the person will be from the response. That is why we have seen in Islamic narrations that they highlight the importance of availing the moments of the softening of the heart. And when someone is broken-hearted, as results of different things, the reason might not be important. When the person is broken-hearted, he is closer to have his response and his request being accepted by the Lord of the worlds. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.